and welcome to Risky Business number 198. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, the makers of Nessus and other fine information security software. Thank you, Tenable, for making this week's show possible. Tenable founder and chief executive Mr. Ron Gula will join us later in the show to discuss the sudden popularity of so-called cyber insurance in light of the massive number of high-profile attacks that have occurred recently, and that's coming up in this week's sponsor interview. In this week's feature interview, we're chatting with Gartner Research Director Andrew Walls about a fascinating research paper released by Microsoft this month. It's called Sex, Lies and Cybercrime Surveys. Awesome title, guys, by the way. And it basically says that most cybercrime surveys are quite misleading. So we'll have more on that for you after the news. But before we get to that, I've got to say that I'm surprised that I haven't had a response to the position that I'm trying to fill in Sydney. I'm looking for a web application security tester, basically a penetration tester for a really plum gig with a great company there in Sydney. And we're talking, you know, a salary of upwards of $140,000 a year, plus bonuses, plus 5 weeks annual leave, daily foot rubs, bottomless tea, all of that sort of stuff. Why aren't I getting applications for this job? I do not get it. If you're interested, email me, patrick@risky.biz, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, @risky.biz, and I can give you some more details. But sheesh, awesome opportunity. I just do not get why you are not applying. So come to me, apply for this job. But right now, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our regular news guest, Mr. Adam Boileau. And Adam, mate, we've got so much news to get through this week. It has just been such a week in information security, and it just seems every week we're getting more and more and more things to discuss. We're going to start off with the obvious story for this week. Lulzsec, the crew that people either love to love or love to hate, have actually been DDoSing. I mean, look, this is proof that they've got basketball-sized steel nuts. They're running a DDoS campaign against CIA.gov.
Yeah, that's probably not going to go so well for them in the long run. But for now, they do appear to be getting some lulls out of that. But yeah, as you say, man, that's some stones right there, you know.
They're not stones, man. They're boulders, okay? When you're pointing your botnets at the CIAs, yeah, you know, that's pretty heavy shizzle.
Yeah, it is, eh? And I'd be interested to see how this whole Lulzsec thing does eventually unfurl, because, I mean, it has to unravel eventually.
Do you think it does, though? I mean, that's the really curious thing. I mean, do you think you can DDoS CIA.gov and get away with it? Because if you can, don't you think, I mean, how much more proof do we need that the emperor has no clothes?
Well, I think, you know, there's one of three ways it can go, right? They can get owned by the government, they can get owned by some other hackers, or they can give up and get bored and go home. And, you know, you've got to think that the fact that they're still alive and trolling the CIA on Twitter, it's because, you know, no one's asked Twitter to stop it yet. The government could get Twitter to turn off that account pretty quick, I would imagine, by now. But, I mean, surely the reason they're still alive is because they're using Tor, and, you know, the government, whoever's sniffing the Twitter tubes, is waiting for them to screw up and, you know, accidentally log into Twitter without Tor once upon a time, and then they will be screwed.
I'd be probably running a few proxies through Iran if I was them.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And I'd be doing my best to avoid those Team Simru sensors, you know?
Yeah, but they only got to fuck up once, and, you know, they will eventually.
Yeah, well, we'll see. There was a fantastic little story published on Ars Technica. I mean, you know, Lulzsec have actually made me lol a couple of times just because of some of the stuff that they've written. This piece on Ars Technica is called Titanic Takeover Tuesday, Lulzsec's Busy Day of Hacking Escapades. You know, they took down The Escapist for no apparent reason. They've hacked a whole bunch of games companies, and they actually hacked a IT security company named Finfisher. And their site was taken down, and I love this quote. This is the one that made me laugh. Their site was taken down briefly because, and quoting from Lulzsec, apparently they sell monitoring software to the government or some shit like that.
And if that ain't good targeting, I don't know what is.
Yeah, they refer to everyone on /B. They're calling them all the B-tards. They're calling them damn furries. And, you know, it's just...
Well, which, to be fair, is probably not without some factual backing.
Man, you're going to get us DDoSed. All right, look, we're going to move away from the Lulzsec stuff for a moment. A bit of interesting news here. Chrome the Chrome browser is now encrypting Gmail, whether you point it to HTTP or HTTPS. By default, the browser now is hard-coded to go directly to HTTPS so that we can avoid the situation like, what's Moxie's tool again called again? It's SSL strip. Yeah, so it's no longer going to be possible to SSL strip Gmail connections, which is a very good thing. They also seem to have addressed the issue of rogue CAs. The Chrome browser for a whole bunch of important websites will only accept certificates signed by certain CAs. So this really does look like a major step forward and one that we've been calling for on this program for some time.
Yeah, we covered the initial announcement when Google were kind of talking about it publicly on one of their security blogs. But yeah, it is an interesting development because, you know, they are standing up and actually doing something a bit different with Chrome. And, you know, it does provide a pretty reasonable, you know, differentiator between Chrome and the other browsers now that they've added this sort of thing. And the fact that they have their own browser really does let them drive this somewhat. I think it's a good thing, good for them. And I for one am glad that I'm not going to get my Gmail man in the middle quite so easily.
Yeah, no, and it is a good sign, and it's also a recognition. It's the first recognition by a vendor, it would seem, by a major vendor, that there's a little bit of trouble with our trust model and when it comes to CAs and stuff like that. So definitely good, definitely needs to be encouraged. Way to go, Google. We've got to keep moving through it because we've got so much to get through this week. Darren Pauly from Secure Computing Magazine here in Australia had an interesting little story about a C-level database being swiped, a laptop containing the details of 66,000 members and clients of the Australian Institute of Company Directors was stolen in just a straight-out theft. It was an opportunistic theft. The CEO of the Australian Institute of Company Directors appears to think that nothing will come of this, but I don't know, that information aggregated like that, even though it's mostly public information, it would be very valuable. I mean, I'd love to get my mitts on that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, it's a good example of, you know, why disk crypto does matter. And apparently this laptop was stolen during a power outage when all the cameras and swipe cards and stuff were online. So that really does point to maybe an insider attack or something that is a little more targeted than perhaps, Mr. John Colvin is giving it credit for.
Yeah. And what is interesting is they say the laptop did not actually have disk encryption, but the data on the computer was protected. And we understand the risk of it being accessed and used for fraudulent purposes is low and blah, blah, blah. I think by that he means it had a password, John Colvin, you might be the CEO of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, but if you weren't rolling full disk crypto on that box, I'd say that data's out there.
Yeah, exactly. And anyone who thinks otherwise, you can give me a copy of their laptop and we'll see how long it takes.
Dealing with another laptop-related issue, the National Health Service over in the United Kingdom went missing. A laptop containing unencrypted health details of over 8.6 million people and the records of 18 million hospital visits, including, you know, details on operations and procedures. Apparently, it was stolen from the storeroom of the London Health Program, according to this piece. I mean, this is, you know, what a disaster.
Yeah, and apparently this is, one of 19 laptops stolen in the same thing, the same exercise. So, yeah, you've got to hope that it is, as you say, just junkies who are going to pawn it off. But, really, we can't reiterate enough how important it is that you crypt this stuff. You know, and full disk crypto is great. If you can't do that, then at least crypt the damn files, you know.
Yeah.
Even in a password-protected spreadsheet, you know, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
just a little bit of crypto.
It's all a little bit fail, isn't it? Another item that I just wanted to touch on quickly, Metasploit has actually launched a cache for exploit program. So they'll have details on some sort of bug, but they won't have the Metasploit module to actually exploit it. They've been offering cash anywhere from $100 to $500, which isn't, you know, a great deal of money. So some people were saying this program was going to flop, but it's been tremendously successful.
Well, yeah, I mean, the internet's a big place and there's lots of people, who I guess would be quite glad of $100, $500. And if you can knock out a exploit, you know, in an hour or two in the evening and you get $500 for it, you know, I guess that's a reasonable evening's work. But yeah, it is a little underpowered compared to the sort of price you'd expect elsewhere in the industry for, you know, weaponized working exploits for usable bugs in the wild.
Yeah, but I'm guessing there's probably some 15-year-olds out there who, for them, claiming $100 for writing a Metasploit module is going to be better than, you know, a week at a paper round.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I'm not saying that it's it's a bad thing, but yeah, it'd be interesting to see, long term whether they keep it up or whether it sort of peters out.
Yeah, no, I was really interested just to see that it was so popular considering the rather humble sums they were offering. Oh, we've got an excellent write-up here in this next piece from, of all places, Al Jazeera has an excellent piece about the arrest of a few people, anonymous, they call them, in Spain. Apparently, these guys have been arrested by Spanish police in connection to attacks on Sony. I think it might even be the PlayStation Network attack. But what's quite funny is the Spanish police came out and said that they'd dismantled the leadership of Anonymous, which just sort of shows that they don't get it.
Well, exactly, yeah, and the way that the Spanish police kind of touted out really did make them look a bit silly, and they've been subject to denial of service attacks from Anonymous at large. But I thought the Al Jazeera write up is actually very, very good. They really put their finger on, exactly why it doesn't make any sense, and the nature of Anonymous itself. It's a label that you put upon yourself. Mm. Not an organization.
It was written by a woman called Layla Nachawati. I think I've got no idea how you correctly pronounce that, but I believe she's some sort of Spanish Syrian activist or something who just happens to really get this stuff. So way to go, Layla.
Yeah, it's great to see such a competent write up in I guess what really is a mainstream media outlet.
Mm, so we'll just have to see how those, if those arrests are really just involving something dumb like DDoS attacks or whether or not it is, the guys who actually did pull off the PSN hack. But we know that three arrests have been made and we'll just have to see how that plays out. Also, it was funnily enough, Anonymous DDoSed the Spanish police website after that, of course, and managed to take it down. But also in Turkey, apparently there's been 32 arrests after a whole bunch of DDoS attacks. It looks like they just got scooped up a whole bunch of people who were using the low orbit ion cannon to DDoS various Anonymous targets. Again, everyone, just because you say you're Anonymous doesn't actually mean you are Anonymous. And I believe eight of the people detained were actually under 18 years old. So there you go. That happened in Turkey.
Yeah, it is quite funny. Kids, be careful while you're DOSing. Don't just use your daddy's cable modem.
Yeah, you might not want to do that. Now some news out of New Zealand. Apparently, the New Zealand Labour Party's website, or one of its systems, was quite vulnerable, and it's resulted in some sort of right-wing blogger threatening to out the names of 450 contributors or something, or email address. Tell me about this, mate.
Yeah, so the local Labour Party's website apparently had directory indexing turned on with a bunch of of internal data lying around. It got indexed by Google. Somebody found it and then fed it to this right wing blogger dude, and then he's threatening to release it. And mostly it's just about embarrassing the Labour Party for being dicks. And by all accounts, it sounds like they were. The funny thing here is that the reports that I read said that one of the first acts accesses to the information that was subsequently then pulled and leaked was actually from the National Party, which is the other competing main party. It was from their mail server. So somebody was browsing around the Labour Party site from National's mail server, or from the place that their has reverse DNS or their mail server, and then onwards from there, which is all very funny. And much is being made of it from a political aspect over here in New Zealand.
So it's actually managed to sneak into the news cycle, has it?
Yeah, it's been getting some mainstream coverage over here. Of course, the funny thing is that no one's actually gone and looked at the National Party's website, which takes credit card payments in the clear. Not very PCI compliant, their guy.
Way to go. Problems on both sides of politics, by the sounds of things, in Middle Earth. Now, this next story deals with a bloke who's having a very bad day. Look, this is an unverified story, but apparently a Bitcoin user managed to lose around $500,000 worth of Bitcoins. Rut roll.
So this guy posted
suicidal
on...
Suicidal panda, in fact.
He posted on the forum.bitcoin.org claiming that his Windows box that had his Bitcoin wallet on it got owned, and then someone transferred 25k Bitcoin off into the ether, which at current exchange rate is something like $500,000 US, which is that's fairly serious business cash. And whilst you feel some sympathy for the dude, you did sign up for untraceable digital currency, right? And then you put all your untraceable digital currency in a brown paper bag on your Windows box.
Yeah, no. Not such a good idea. And I love the quote in this forum post, the initial one saying, oh my God, I feel like killing myself. I'm pissed off and blah, blah, blah. If only I'd done this, if only I'd done that. And I think it's the second from last line is needless to say, I feel like I have lost faith in Bitcoin. Yeah.
It's all right. Yeah. Further on down the forum thread, someone suggested he talk to the police.
Yes. All right, moving on. And look, the New York Times actually posted an awful, awful write-up of the Citigroup or the Citi data leak or the Citi hack, you know, where 200,000 credit card details apparently walked. We covered it in the news segment last week. And you actually wrote a little write-up for the Risky.biz blog about that. It's funny, isn't it? Because the New York Times piece essentially says, oh, it was an incredibly sophisticated attack, and then goes on to describe the attack as you know, attackers actually manipulating URLs to gain the data, which doesn't sound too sophisticated to me. It can't be both, can it?
Well, no, I think, you know, the story did suggest that they manipulated the account number in the URL bar, which obviously is not a particularly sophisticated attack. But yeah, from the perspective of the New York Times, I think sophisticated means used a computer.
Yes. But anyone who's interested can go and check out Adam's write-up of that. It's at risky.biz/city, which is C-I-T-I, obviously. And yeah, go have a read of that. It's a very fun piece, mate. Thank you again for writing it. Moving on, it's time to take a big...
drink.
Yep, time to take a big swig. Patch Tuesday time again. Microsoft has issued a doozy, 34 holes. Adobe has fixed a flash bug. Wow, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, the only thing that's missing here is obviously there must be some Java patches due or maybe some QuickTime or something like that. Yes, as usual, go patch your shit. I hadn't even kept track of what the, you know, 34 Microsoft holes are. Apparently some of them are SMB bugs, IE bugs, like the usual sort of things. But goddamn, you know, you'd think these numbers would be going down by now, but no.
Now, it really does feel like Risky Business has, you know, all we're doing these days is running rolling coverage of the Ponzocalypse. and the latest victim in the Ponzocalypse is the International Monetary Fund. Of course, it made massive headlines last week when it happened. The IMF got owned, presumably by state-sponsored attackers. Very interesting piece. But, you know, the thing that I find interesting about this is it will hit the headlines everywhere and it says, you know, IMF hacked, blah, 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 blah. But really, I mean, every single similar body is owned up the wazoo right now. The only difference is the IMF somehow figured out that they got owned. And, you know, since they booted out these guys, there's probably a whole new group of attackers rattling around in their systems ever since. So as much as it is good to see news like this pointing out that there's been some high-profile breaches, really it's kind of not news because everyone's owned.
Well, yeah, and of course there's also no follow-up. We don't get to discover, you know, exactly what got owned, what those attackers did inside the IMF, which I'm sure would be very interesting, and then, you know, how the IMF found it, how they responded to it, what they're going to do next. Like, none of the important information actually gets conveyed out to us. And even inside the industry, like, I don't expect, you know, the mainstream press to cover it, but even inside the industry, we don't get really good information like that. And until we do, how the hell are we going to judge at all the scale of the problem? And all we're left with, as you said, is we have to assume that everybody is owned all the time and, you know, by whom, doing what, we don't know, which is hardly ideal.
Oh, here's a little bread and butter actual InfoSec story for you QSAs out there. The reason I highlighted this one, I think this is quite funny, is that... you know, the PCI Security Standards Council has actually issued some virtualization guidelines to supplement PCI DSS 2.0. And I'm like, hang on, you know, you only just released these guidelines? Are they behind or is this a different set of guidelines? Is this an update? What's this all about, Adam?
I believe they are actually new. They do address, you know, exactly how you're supposed to handle virtualization in the context of PCI. And also, looking forward, we are, at some point in the future, expect standards relating to the use of mobile devices with credit cards. And that will be very exciting because, you know, that could be quite a growth industry.
It's only 4 years late, but there you go. Way to go, PCI Security Standards Council. And anyone who's interested can go forth and find their virtualization guidelines. Facepalm. Anyway, more news out of New Zealand in our rolling coverage of the
Ponzocalypse.
Distribute.it. Distribute it. Is that how you say it?
Distribute it. Distributite.
Whatever. They're an online services wholesaler. I think they're a domain registrar and all of that sort of stuff. They got majorly worked over. We saw a Whirlpool thread pop up about that, and there's been some press articles. But, you know, just a standard sort of online service provider being owned up by the looks of things.
Yeah, these guys appear to have been taken pretty hard, actually. I mean, they've been nearly offline for, what is it, like a week now or something? Like, it's really been a long time for the customers, and you can see some of the rage on the forums.
Yeah.
It looks like they got taken to with some, some fairly vicious amount of RMRF sharks. So, does make you wonder, how targeted, whether it's an insider, whether it's someone who's disgruntled with their service. Because, actually really burning someone down hard, that takes some reason to do it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess you shouldn't have fired that that sort of unstable admin guy, huh? It'll get you every time. And, mate, this final story, I got to say, it made me lull and it warmed my heart. It was a piece written up by Darren Pawley, again, for Secure Computing Magazine in Australia. A bunch of left-wing hackers stole 400 names and home addresses of Germany's neo-Nazi party and published them on Google Maps, which I just think is bloody terrific. Because what? I don't think Nazis really deserve a right to privacy. I reckon we should know where they live. And I think we should publish that information so the f***ers have to move.
Yeah, well, I have to say fucking A, right? This is exactly the sort of thing that, Duck was blogging about, having using your powers of hacking for something other than just plain lulz. Although in this case, as you said, like it is pretty lulz-worthy. It's a
good
use. I
don't think this is exactly what Paul Ducklin was talking about when he wrote using...
exactly, but...
I think he was more, Ducklin, I love Duck. If anyone's interested too, Paul Ducklin, who's a pretty prominent security commentator, he works for Sophos here in Australia. He wrote a really good blog post about Lulzsec and about how they really need to, develop a moral compass and go out there and start doing useful things. But I don't think hacking Nazis is quite what he meant.
I don't know. I'm sure he's in favour of hacking Nazis.
I like Duck because he's such a straighty 180, but he's, and he gets all fired up as well. But God bless him. But, I actually am going to be on the ABC show PM this evening talking about the Lulzsec thing. And I said in response to Paul's position that Lulzsec should be out there doing community service, we're talking about computer security issues and we're talking about the need for organizations to better secure their customers' information because of the actions of a group that didn't exist 3 weeks ago. So they've done so much to put this stuff on the agenda that it's really difficult to it's really difficult to hate them, basically, even though what they're doing is technically wrong.
Yeah, and every box that they cause someone to roll incident response on is one less box that's already been owned by somebody else on the quiet, Mm. Now Sony's probably rooted out, the other 200 people who've owned them whilst they're in the process of rolling incident response. So, that's a good outcome.
Yep. All right, Adam, we actually managed to get through all of the news this week, which was a hell of an achievement to do it in the regular allotted time. Thank you so much for joining us, mate, and we will chat to you again next week.
See you then, Pat. Cheers.
Adam Boileau with a look at the week's news headlines there. Right now, it's time for a chat with Gartner's Andrew Walls, and we're talking to him about a Microsoft research paper titled Sex, Lies, and Cybercrime Surveys. The basic premise of the paper, which was written by Dinay Florencio, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, and his colleague Cormac Hurley, the basic premise is that cybercrime surveys generally can't be relied on, just as surveys dealing with sexual matters often produce distorted results. And it's a really nice read, and they draw some very interesting parallels there. Now, I tried getting the authors of the paper onto the show, but for whatever reason, Microsoft PR isn't so keen on letting them talk about this paper. Andrew Walls is a research director at Gartner and a knowledgeable chap all round, a knowledgeable analyst. So I thought we'd get him on in their place to discuss this research. And here's what Andrew had to say.
Well, fundamentally, what they're saying is somewhat obvious. Surveys, as they're reported in a lot of the popular media, are not really serving us very well to show us truth, as it were, or to provide better insights into what's really going on. That can be a result of poor samples or poor sample sizes, inappropriate profiling of the target audience and so forth. There are a variety of reasons why the results of a survey might be skewed or just wildly incorrect. But the end result is that quite a lot of the analysis comes out of surveys can be flawed.
Yeah, now they speak specifically about how losses, like when they're talking about these cybercrime surveys, how losses can often be amplified. How is that occurring?
Well, a lot of this, if you're familiar with like how medical epidemiological studies work, the idea is that you look at a sample population and you look at the rate of incidence of a particular ailment, syndrome, whatever, and then based on models that have been tested in real life, you extrapolate from that sample to the greater population and say, in our sample size, we saw 5% of children with this particular situation later on contract this disease. So we can say across the entire population of Australia, we should expect this rate of incidence of that disease based on our models. The problem we run into in security and cybersecurity and cybercrime and all those wonderful things is that we're fine at going out there and getting a sample representation. You know, go out and call 100 people and ask them whether their credit card has ever been misused after using it online. Easy to get that. But what we don't have is proven models that allow us to extrapolate from our sample to the greater population. And so we'll see, you know, a certain rate of incidence of, you know, money being stolen out of bank accounts or credit card fraud occurring or passwords being sniffed or whatever the item is that we're chasing. And we'll just say, okay, 10% of our sample had that happen to them. So 10% of the population at large will have that happen to them. Therefore, cybercrime is costing Australia $5 billion a year.
Yeah, yeah.
But that extrapolation is not valid.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they really do seem to be arguing here that people tend to be extrapolating some pretty wild figures. Where it gets really interesting and a little bit funny, actually, this paper is where they actually draw some lessons learned from distortions in surveys dealing with sex.
Yeah, well, I thought that was a great way to... I'm always a great believer of you start first with the catchy title, and then you figure out the research to fill in behind it.
It actually works quite well, though, here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because to quote my favorite television, Dr. House, everybody lies. And this should come as no surprise to anybody in the security field because everybody does lie. and that's true in surveys. And it is immediately apparent and provably a situation when you look at surveys of how many people have a particular individual had sex with. Men say they have, you know, hundreds of partners, and women say they've had a few. Well, those both can't be true.
Yeah, I think the old joke is that whatever men say, you halve it, and whatever women say, you double it.
That could work. I hope that doesn't apply to cybercrime, but yeah.
Yeah, I think the point they're trying to make, too, is that only some people were being untruthful in surveys dealing with sexual issues, but it would actually skew the entire sample and lead to some incorrect inferences.
Well, that's the issue with sample size. If you have a small sample size, let's say a few thousand respondents, which is a pretty large sample grouping, and you have a handful of respondents who are just wild, hyperbolic exaggerators. And so they say, yeah, I got hit by online fraud, and they took $50,000 from me. Okay, now most of the respondents say, no, never saw a thing. Or, yeah, I lost 10 bucks. Or, you know, I had to call the credit card company and reverse a transaction. But all it takes is that handful of people that said they lost lots and lots of money to skew the results upward. And if they then say out of 3,000 people sampled, the average loss was $1,500, and then you just multiply that by the population of a country, well, there's your loss to online fraud. It doesn't scale. The extrapolation is invalid.
It almost seems, too, that the companies that are often backing these surveys, you know, they do have a vested interest in overstating the problem. The thing with these surveys is that they are actually largely conducted as a bit of a press exercise. So they get some company to do a survey, telephone survey, they sit down, they sort of extrapolate it, they turn it into a trends report or something, wackadoo, goes into a press release and winds up in a journalist's inbox. And there is pressure to report on stuff like that. But, you know, I've never been too keen on doing that because really what you're doing is you're taking a survey from an organization that really has a vested interest in overstating the problem. And, you know, reporting it as fact. And it just, it's really nice to see Microsoft actually come out and do this research.
And one thing I really like that they pointed out in this paper that they produced, too, is that the critical part of reporting survey results is to provide enough information about how the survey was conducted, you know, the sample size, how that sample size was constructed. You know, what people did you select, or what systems did you select if it was an automated process, what the mean was, what the median was, you know, all these sorts of things, so that a knowledgeable reader could analyze the survey results that are being reported and critique them in a knowledgeable fashion. What happens too often in the reporting of survey results, and by reporting I don't mean by journalists, I just mean how survey results get put out to the public, is that sort of information is not provided, and the greater public really knows nothing about statistical analysis.
I think journalists really need to learn to ask for that sort of stuff when it isn't provided.
Yeah, but we've all been hearing for a number of years about how, you know, the analytical process in journalism has been dying a slow death, especially in mainstream media. And I'm not an expert on that, but there is always an interest in a salacious headline.
Mm.
And more often than not, I will see headlines that promote the negative with very little analysis of whether that negative is a valid item. It will bring in readers, and sometimes in that pursuit of readership, I think it can be very seductive to maybe not do as incisive analysis as one ought. But that's why we have a market for material, and people who are looking for nuance and good analysis will find the appropriate journalists, such as yourself, who will dig into the facts behind the initial report and try to see whether the emperor has any clothes or not.
Oh, flattery will get you everywhere, Andrew. That's fantastic. Bring it on. Now, one thing to note too, and I found this quite funny in the conclusion to this paper, is they discuss that age-old security wisdom, which is you never trust user input. And yet they say in these surveys, the people conducting these surveys inherently just trust whatever the user is telling them and trust whatever the respondent is telling them.
Yeah, I did love that nice twist in that last couple of paragraphs. Unfortunately, the simple fact of the matter is that you have to analyze the data you can get. And in lieu of any other data, bad data is what you go with, and you try to analyze it to the best extent you can. So, for example, when I conduct surveys, the mere fact that somebody refuses to respond is interesting data.
Well, that's right, and it's also when people do choose to respond as well. That skews things, because you've got something, and this is a concept that I did want to go into during this interview. Many years ago, I did write a story about an online poll. Now, online polls are completely meaningless, and I contacted several polling companies to discuss this. The reason it's meaningless is because you've got this thing called self-selection bias, where if you allow people to basically decide whether or not they're going to participate in a survey, there's usually a reason that they're deciding to participate or not to participate into a survey. So you wind up with people with all sorts of motivations that aren't entirely clear being the primary motivation for them to actually respond to these things. And that also works in things like cybercrime surveys, even the reputable ones, because quite often they send these survey packs to companies. Now, a lot of companies might only respond to a survey like that because they've had some sort of incident. You would think, you know, if everything's been honky-dory, they're like, do I really want to fill out this whole survey just to say that everything's fine? And that's the whole concept of self-selection or self, you know, non-selection bias in surveys,
right,
which is an important one. Exclusion, yes, that's the word.
And this applies to situations other than surveys also. So, for example, the participation in a CERT process where you do voluntary reporting to an industry body of some form, even if it's anonymized, many large organizations refused to participate in that fashion, to give, you know, candid descriptions of the actual level and type of incidents they experience. Well, the CERT organizations have to go with the data they have, but they know it is not an even comprehensive representation of what's really occurring in industry, but it is the data they have. And so with those caveats applied to it, they publish that data, but they're candid about the limitations of the data, and that's the critical part. Any good researcher who has collected data in any way, survey or otherwise, has to understand the limitations of their data and publish those limitations as part of the research process. And that's something that can be lacking in some forms of cybercrime survey. In particular, as you were speaking of earlier, you have to look at the, if you will, vested interests of the organizations that are conducting the survey or simply analyzing the data and publishing it. It's going to be a very interesting day, for example, when an anti-malware company produces and publishes the results of a survey that shows that malware is not that big a problem at the moment.
Yeah, or that fraud is falling and Zeus is kind of under control.
Exactly. Now, hopefully someday that will occur, and that should be a pat on their back saying, hey, you're doing a good job, your products are working real well and all that. But
that's going to be hilarious, man. Do you really think that's going to... Anyway, sorry. That's another topic.
Well, yeah, but this is part of a marketing effort. This is, and in their defense, I'm sure you know there are many, many organizations and individuals out there who need those products. And so I'm not trying to disparage the quality of product out there, but it's in a vendor's best interest to highlight the things that will motivate client engagement and deprecate those things that would discourage a client from engaging. So it's a natural thing. For people to do this. And that also leads into what's called confirmation bias.
Mm.
And I see this, for example, in the security field when it comes to things like risk assessments, which are a form of survey.
Well, that's confirmation bias is when someone has a pre-built, ready-made thesis already going on in their head, and then they only accept evidence that supports their position. And they sort of subconsciously discard stuff that doesn't fit with their thinking.
Right, but they also subconsciously discard people who don't agree with their thinking. And so in a security department, it is very typical to see a staff complement that's all engaging in groupthink simply because of the way they were recruited. And so the risks are all aligned. Everyone agrees with them because they were hired because they agree.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be a very dangerous thing. And this is one of the things in my own humble opinion, IMHO and all that, why I think a lot of business people disengage from and commence to ignore security departments, because security departments produce risk statements and what appears to be hyperbolic threat descriptions that do not align with the business person's experience, personal experience. And at a certain point, the business person says, this guy's playing Chicken Little. And even if the entire security department agrees, the business person might not listen. This tendency is rife in the industry. We have commercial interests that would promote threats and risks because that's our job security. We do sincerely believe that those threats and risks are there. And so we have a real struggle on our hands of trying to get a candid, valid assessment that is not colored or prejudiced by our own preconceptions. It's not an easy thing to do.
Well, the one question I have, in light of this paper, Andrew, the one last question I have on this is whether or not you feel that the bulk, having read this paper, whether or not you feel the bulk of cybercrime surveys that you've read and that you've seen out there might perhaps be, exaggerating the problem. Do you feel that we actually do have accurate cybercrime data out there?
No, I do not believe that we have accurate cybercrime data being reported. There is accurate cybercrime data available out there, but it tends to be in academic research and not so much in commercially sponsored research. Although there are some organizations, some of the major telecommunications organizations that also provide managed security services that are able to simply monitor their networks and study the flow of malicious traffic and then report on that. That's valid, but that's a different thing than cybercrime. That's just, malware in the wild, if you will. And it doesn't necessarily have an immediate impact on a company in terms of material loss. So that's a different thing than crime. That's rate of, not even incidents, rate of availability or something of malware on networks. That can be useful, but we shouldn't assume that that translates into direct impact on particular organizations. But getting decent, verified, trustable data about cybercrime is a non-trivial pursuit. And even governments engage in this sort of hyperbole and confirmation bias, particularly around budget time. If you need money, you throw cybercrime into your department name or whatever. And so it's very difficult to find data that's meaningful. What I would advise readers and listeners to do is to insist on more transparency about how the survey was conducted, who were the respondents? I don't mean names, but, you know, what are their demographic data? You know, countries, industries, size, that sort of thing. Ask questions about mean and median separation so you can get a feel whether the responses are actually clustered in a certain area or so forth. And then fortunately, get familiar with some basic concepts of statistics so that you can actually read the reports and the analysis and make sense of it and not simply run off on a mistaken premise and start making purchasing decisions and modifications of procedures and so forth. It takes some analysis and it takes some good critical thinking about what's actually being reported. And most importantly, don't base everything on a single source. You have to look far, and you have to look wide, and you have to look at sources that you don't agree with. You have to look at organizations that are reporting things that don't feel right to you, but you still need to look at what they have reported.
And you need to look at how they arrived at those conclusions as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't just assume because you don't agree with it, it's wrong. It could be right.
It all sounds like good advice to me. Andrew Walls, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, Patrick.
Andrew Walls of Gartner there with a look at the Microsoft research paper, Sex, Lies, and Cybercrime Surveys. And I'm sure if you Google that name, you will find the paper itself. It's really interesting stuff. Okay, it's time for this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's show was made possible through the generous support of Tenable Network Security. Our sponsors get to come onto the show in the last interview to chat about current events, and this week we're chatting with Tenable's chief executive, Ron Gula, about so-called cyber insurance. The news service Reuters ran a really interesting article this week that claimed large organizations are moving to insure the risk posed to them by electronic intruders. It's titled, Hacking Blitz Drives Cyber Insurance Demand, in case you want to look it up. I got Ron on the line to ask him what he thought about this apparent trend.
I think the insurance industry has been, you know, trying to do something like this. And since there have been so many different kind of incidents, it allows those people at the insurance companies to, you know, come up with, you know, the right values for, you know, putting a dollar amount on this kind of thing. They can actually, you know, they're quantifying risk. I would love to chat with them and actually see, you know, what's it cost? You know, what are they actually putting out there for policies and what are the terms of those conditions?
Yeah, look, it strikes me as being quite interesting as well, because you really wonder if they do understand the risk. The report that we're discussing here, it actually goes into detail about how the banks, you know, will insure you but won't insure you against losses, data losses that come from things like unencrypted laptops. So it looks like, you know, the insurance sector might actually be moving into a position where it's a standards driver for operational security, which can only be a good thing, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot of good things when you go to insurance and they want, you know, certain types of policies on your executive, certain types of, you know, limits on who can spend money, you know, things like that. You'd be surprised how many businesses go out of business because they don't have those simple kind of controls in their organization. And the bigger the organizations are, they don't have simple kinds of controls on their security policies and their security technologies. So if somebody goes out and says, we want to buy some insurance to help protect us, and oh, by the way, you need to do A, B, and C, and D, and the company wasn't doing any of those things, that's generally going to help the industry. So I definitely think this is a good thing.
Now, the reason that I really wanted to discuss this with you is because, you know, you are an industry veteran at this point, which is funny because it's one of those industries, information security, which has the youngest so-called veterans of any industry on the planet. But you've been around long enough to remember the talk around 10 years ago that really suggested that, wow, in the future, in the very soon, you know, the very near future, insurance companies are really going to drive standards in information security. Companies are going to have to insure this stuff. They're going to really have to improve operational security to bring down their premiums, things like that. Do we think it's different this time? Do we think that this string of high-profile attacks has really changed the environment to the degree that organizations are starting to take this insurance stuff seriously?
I think that there's definitely a point in time where we're at, but you have to kind of look back just a year or two ago when most of the risk, so to speak, was dominated by inadvertent data loss, right? I might lose my payroll list, my customer list, my mailing list, you know, whatever you, and if I live in Massachusetts, I'm going to have to do one thing, California, something else. Everybody was really worried about that. But now in 2011, you know, we've gone back those 10 years and we're having major outages right now. Like, so Sony's had PS3 offline for a long time. We're having intellectual property stolen, right? You know, RSA has, you know, basically been, had their authentication devices, you know, totally owned and what and whatnot. And those are completely different kinds of high profile thefts. I'm, you know, you can extrapolate that and, you know, expect people to be, you know, launching nuclear weapons and stealing the secret recipe for Coke and whatnot. So I think this round of cybersecurity sort of insurance is really more about just insuring the cyber aspect of that business. Most modern businesses who have some form of risk management, and part of that risk management is to get insurance for things they can't really control, is to buy insurance. So I don't really think this is a this is just a good next step for our industry. Nothing very, very groundbreaking or brand new.
But I mean, if that risk has been understood and they have insured against all sorts of risks, why is it that they haven't done that until now? That's kind of what I'm asking. And I suspect that the Reuters article is quite correct when it has to do with not so much the extent of breaches. I mean, you look at Heartland, TJ Maxx, all of them. I mean, they were disasters for the organizations involved. The thing that separates this current batch of incidents isn't so much the effect on the organizations involved, but the publicity surrounding them. How much do you think the publicity is actually driving this move to insure?
The publicity is definitely driving something because it has the human notion of wanting to respond and do something, right? So if you're sitting in the board of directors at a major publicly traded company and there's a team of top security analysts, they've got intrusion detection, SIMs, good policies, they, the pen tests don't get in, and yet you see all these things in the news, in like Sony and RSA and whatnot, there's still an emotional response as we want to do something, right? Well, hey, why not buy insurance for something that you can't control? Now, on the other hand, there's probably people out there who know that they're totally open and maybe they're buying insurance. So now the question really is in the insurance company's point of view, is it like selling, you know, hurricane insurance during hurricane season, earthquake, you know, insurance during, you know, when after an earthquake? You know, sometimes you wonder if these insurance companies are biting off more than they can chew. But I've dealt with some of these kind of policies and the kind of things that customers are asked to do. Very often it's like, hey, like, do you have a vulnerability management program? And literally, you know, one company might interpret that as, let's run out and buy Nessus, do a scan, and voila, that's a vulnerability management. On the other hand, it might be, hey, we're going to put agents everywhere, we're going to force patching, we're not going to let anybody on the network, you know, unless they're patched. Well, that's another form of vulnerability management. Sometimes the insurance companies aren't, you know, 100%, you know, descriptive of exactly what you need to do. So I think there's going to be a lot of room to grow and a lot of opportunities to, you know, help refine those kind of models.
But do you also think that it's possible the insurance companies don't quite know what they're getting into and could wind up taking a bath on this sort of insurance?
Well, you know, the insurance companies, they're a business, right? So they're not going to offer a product unless they know what the risk is, right? So imagine a cyber security insurance that was more about brand protection or brand awareness, you know. Maybe they just want to insure the fact that the website that they own, you know, maybe somebody puts malicious content right there and they want insurance to, you know, indemnify themselves or somehow help themselves in case somebody puts something offensive, you know, on there, you know, an anti-Al-Qaeda message or, you know, something along those lines, something politically motivated, things like that. You'd be amazed how often a large company might get attacked with some sort of class action lawsuit because of something like that. So you can find very, very tactical things. But to get an insurance policy that says, you know, I want to cover myself for any possible thing that might go wrong and land me in the Wall Street Journal that's cyber-related, that's probably not going to be very realistic. An insurance company is going to be much, much more tactical about what they're going to cover.
Now, this is where I find it really interesting because you actually hit the nail right on the head. These guys understand risk better than everyone else, especially people in InfoSec who claim to understand risk but really don't. Okay, so insurance companies really understand risk and they're looking for good risks. They're looking for risks that they can make money on. You know, they're very educated gamblers, these guys. So what I'm wondering is if we get to a situation where sort of information security insurance becomes the standard, that puts insurance companies into a terribly influential position. So at the moment, you know, if you can't get insurance for cargo on a ship, the ship won't sail. Simple as that. So what I'm wondering is if this insurance sort of becomes standard, do you think we could get into a situation where some of the big insurers will say, look, we're going to insure you against this, this, and this, but you can't run Adobe Flash. Do you think that's possible, that they could drive adoption to that point of view and then really drive some change in the industry?
It's possible, but I really think that, you know, Adobe would have some objections to that. You know, if you eradicate Adobe and you replace it with HTML5 or some, then that's just the next thing that's going to have the vulnerability. So you're regulating yourself into a new form of vulnerabilities that you're unprepared for.
Sure, sure. But I accept that, Ron, but but doesn't it send a message to the market and send a message to developers of the next product that they really need to put more effort into their SDL and actually making better products? Doesn't it give us an incremental gain?
No, I really don't have a problem with the model, because let's say that an insurance company is only going to limit themselves to companies that get it, right? And all the listeners can kind of interpret that for whatever they need. But some company that knows what they're doing, they have a risk management program, good firewall team, good antivirus, APT, people finding stuff, pen testers don't succeed, all those kind of good things. Even with those guys, what they're doing is they're operating in a world of, you know, rather than getting owned all the time, we really don't know. You know, we might be getting known by, you know, Uber hackers and stuff like that. But, you know, everything seems to be running normally and we're good. Well, even in that case, you still have a lot of risk in that there could be a string of 0 days, people targeting you, things like that. So why not spend a little bit of cash, pool your risk profile with other companies who have similar kind of risk profiles as you do, and get some insurance? I mean, that's the whole game. It's just shared. You put a little bit of money in and you share that risk, and inadvertently, if you do get owned or you do have some sort of cyber outage, then you can benefit from that that cover. So I don't have any problem with that business model. Now, if the insurance companies start mixing in other people who have a different risk profile than I do, then it's a bad deal for me, and it's possibly a bad deal for the insurance company. I would want to be a company who's insured, and part of my pool comes from a company whose their risk profile is completely different than mine. So that's where I think the devil's in the details with this kind of policy.
I guess you're saying that it's a little bit more nuanced than just than just forbidding the use of certain products.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can look at the whole healthcare thing, right? If I am a healthy, I run, I don't smoke, I don't eat red meat, you know, I go to bed on time, I say my prayers, I'm a low risk person. I would never enter into a policy that was targeted for, you know, smokers. You know, it's just not, that's not my risk profile. It would be a bad thing. Or, you know, perhaps, you know, the older you are, the harder it is to buy newer types of insurance. I mean, because of the classic kind of risk models there. It's the same thing with cyber insurance. So, you know, if you're out there and you say, hey, gee, I think this is something I want to invest in for my company, you should really be aligning your company with other companies of similar risk. Otherwise, you're really not benefiting from the concept of insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a fascinating development, and we're going to have to keep our eye on it and see if it's a trend that continues. But Ron Gula, thank you so much for joining us this week to have a discussion around so-called cyber insurance.
Hey, thanks for having me, and good luck buying that cyber insurance.
Ron Gula there, and sorry about the occasional crackle there on that interview. I really don't know why that happened. So I'll try to trace the gremlin, but it might just remain a mystery. And that's it for this week's show. Playing us out this week is another track by that South African group that I've told you all about, Big Dreams. This song's a little bit political, it's a little bit religious, but I really like it. And also, big thanks to Virtual Office, that's spelt O-F-F-I-S. Thanks to them for hosting Risky Business, hosting the risky.biz website. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you so much for listening.
Yo, back in the day, you know it started out as a dream. It started when a black man wanted to live as a king. Martin Luther was the early bird that started to sing. Free as a bee was a phrase that started catching the scene. Hector Peterson was shot dead fighting for freedom, trying hard to get the African spirit of kingdom. 27 years in prison, Mandela the hero, fighting the war not with bullets but lyrical wisdom. Soon as he stepped out the cell, everybody thought
revenge.
9 mils, 47s, gunpowders and
grenades.
Up the hill, burn them down, bring them down, leave them. On your marks, get set and get ready to attack. But no, Mandela took them all by surprise, like whoa. Showed everyone we need peace and not war. If we could all relate to what this man did, then probably the line of peace would be expanded.
Feel so good.
different kind of love, the love we receive from above.
It feels so good to be loved so bad.
It's a different kind of love, the love we receive from above. All these predicaments that walk us through life in fear, the tears that fall down the eyes of the child in fear. The purest of the fruit of life is inside of me. The evolution of disciples of Christ is here, living in total righteousness through this time of sin. Punching each line harder than Tyson can bite your ears. Reflecting each time the span spills a mile from here. I'm thankful each time I wake up or at night I sleep. I respirate my mind with positive thoughts. Dream of a world but one country, equally alive and resourced. No prejudice, discrimination and hate. Adjust your mind to focus wider, what's important only God can say. Express my soul through this progression and chord, and realize that only I can make it right and make it sound like a song. And God forgive the ones that frequently sin, yeah. And God forgive the ones that frequently sin, yeah.
It feels so good to be loved so bad.
It's a different kind of love, the love we receive from above. Different kind of love, the love we receive from above.
It feels so good to be loved so bad.
It's a different kind of love, the love we receive from above.
It feels so good to be loved so bad.
It's a different kind of love, the love we receive from above.